The Seven Veils of Privacy, How Our Debates About Privacy Conceal Its Nature is a new book by Kieran O'Hara. He's discussing that privacy has an image problems and that the debates about them are stymied by divergent views on its definition, purpose and value. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from probably a hidden location somewhere in Europe, Kieran O'Hara. Kieran, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Nice to see you. Yes, I'm in The Hague in the Netherlands.
Oh, right. Fine. Very, very nice part of the world, too. Now, privacy. We all think we're entitled to it. Some of us think we shouldn't have any. Public figures are not allowed to have privacy, etc., etc. But do you really know what privacy is, Kieran?
Well, this is the great question. I've been working in this field for 20-odd years. I was a computer scientist originally, so I was interested in things like cybersecurity, data protection, all that stuff. I came on the field before smartphones, before social media. All that was a total surprise to me. If you'd told me that people would give their information away to American tech giants for free services, I would have been astonished, and yet people do. What I've come to discover over the years is that when we think about privacy as a technical problem, like me as a thinking about cybersecurity, we tend to think about privacy very narrowly. And that doesn't really map on to what ordinary people in the street think about privacy as it affects their daily lives. And this is really what the book is about.
But it's interesting you say people giving away their information to American tech giants. But it's a sort of insidious way, isn't it, that it goes through? It's almost friendly, cuddly way. I mean, if you go into those, find out what you would have been like in the Middle Ages or what your superhero name is be, then that's a way of that people can collect data sort of underhand kind of way. But it's the sort of touchy-feely, user-friendly way that people can quite willingly and quite innocently hand over that information.
That's right. And let me also say that most of that information isn't really misused, and it's not used against you. It's used for your benefit. But anything we do online, of course, involves my computer sending information to your computer and you're sending it back. All you have to do is store that information, and then you've got quite a good record of what's going on. And as we do more and more and more things online, we have a more and more complete record.
So what, because you call this the Seven Veils of Privacy. Now, I spot this now, those of us, it was Seven Veils in the Dance, I suppose. So are we stripping away the various, I don't expect you to disrobe, Kieran, but are we stripping away the various levels of privacy and defining what is vital for our privacy? If there is such a thing, I mean, we can get very conceptual on this.
We can. I don't mind disrobing on radio. it is a very different matter. There are lots of different views, and whenever a new technology emerges or a new practice, there are new privacy concerns that come about. The first caveman who knocked a hole in the side of his cave to let the light in and the smoke out created a new privacy problem that we didn't have before. Right, he could be seen, and the same. The big thing for privacy concerns in Europe were first of all the growth of the state after the Second World War, the Cold War, security, the welfare state, all that stuff, and then of course the invention of databases, computers doing all that analysis, and we suddenly realised actually the reach of this stuff is quite dramatic.
So, I mean, has the concept of privacy sort of changed over the years? Because obviously the internet computers have completely revolutionized the way that how our private lives can suddenly be transformed or discovered and then transmitted. And therefore that can have a life-changing effect on people's life. You only have to look at how the way that social media, if unchecked, has made some people, be revealed falsely for doing things that they haven't done and being ostracized and in some cases much worse. So has our idea of privacy changed over, say, from the end of the Second World War or going back earlier? Because some things had to be put out, quote unquote, for the good of the public, presumably. You couldn't be entirely private.
It, it, Absolutely. Well, I mean, yeah, no one can be entirely private, and that's exactly right. And no one wants to be entirely private. You know, we all want to be visible. We want to be, you know, here are you and I having a conversation, but we're having it on air in front of many thousands, hundreds of thousands of listeners. So I think what's happened is our notions of privacy haven't changed. They've just grown. Right. So 1,000 years ago, we had a legend in England about Peeping Tom and looking at Lady Godiva's naked body. That was 1,000 years ago. Peeping Tom breached her privacy then. And I think we'd say he breached her privacy now. It's not changed. We haven't changed our view of this.
Yeah.
Whereas on the other hand, our view of democracy has changed, you know, because women couldn't vote until fairly recently. And we would think that's actually quite undemocratic not to have women voting, whereas, you know, 100 years ago, you think it was quite democratic. So democracy has changed. That sort of thing has changed. Our view of privacy has just grown and grown as more and more things have become relevant to it.
So let's take us through some of the where you start from with this book and make it understandable, though, for the layperson, as it were.
So a lot of what goes on in the serious study of privacy in universities or by policymakers, lawyers, and so on, technologists, is focused on usually very specific problems. And those problems don't really map on to ordinary people's concerns. And this is when I talk about the seven veils. There are several different levels about of how we want to discuss privacy, and they tend to get munched together in a great mass that makes our discussions quite confusing. So the seven different sets of discussions we have are, so there's one basic one about what is privacy, and that's the one we've been focusing on so far today. And that's the basic one. You know, when do we spot privacy? And perhaps more important, when do we spot when your privacy has been breached, when has somebody intruded? So there's that question. There's a second level, which is, okay, given we live in a particular environment, and that might be a physical environment, or it might be a virtual environment like our computers or whatever it might happen to be. How does that help privacy, and how does it hinder privacy? Right. So the environment Windows will let people see in. Frosted glass will stop people seeing it. Okay, simple things like that. A door lock will stop people getting in, but a keyhole will enable people to look in without being seen. All that sort of stuff. A third level is, how does privacy affect us? Right. Think about having a shower in the morning. You're on your own. It feels like you're very private. On the other hand, compare that with having a shower with your mates down at the sports club after a game, or having a shower with an intimate lover, or having a shower accidentally, you know, in the middle of the street. You know, these things all they feel very different in very different ways. So there's the way privacy feels and how the lack of privacy feels. Then there's, what privacy do we want? When do we want to be private? You know, our preferences. Do we want to be private at all? Maybe I want to be out shouting the merits of my book from the rooftops rather than being private at home. Then there's the sort of the social norms of privacy. You know, what's it right to do? You know, in the Netherlands, where I spend a lot of my time, they tend to leave their curtains open and the lights on. Now, in Britain, where I was brought up, everyone would just stare in through the window. They would just pop in and that would be... whereas the norm in the Netherlands is not to do that. People just walk past. For a Brit, it's very hard not to try a sidelong glance and see what people are doing. But the Dutch would never dream of doing it. The sixth level is the laws, you know, like the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR and all that. And then the final level is, well, what are the rights and wrongs? What privacy rights do we have as human rights? When is it right to invade someone's privacy? For example, I've got a tell the government what I earn every year, and that's quite right, because that's how it can calculate my taxes. So all those different conversations tend to get munched together to create rather complicated situations, which mean that everyone's talking past each other.
Yeah, and I suppose it's an unmanageable. If you don't break it down, then it's an unmanageable concept or subject to talk about.
Exactly. So for example, suppose I have my privacy preferences, and they might be unreasonable, right? So that's talking about my preferences, but it's also talking about the social norms that say whether things are reasonable or not. Just because my preferences are unreasonable, it doesn't stop them being my preferences.
Yeah, exactly. Also, the other thing, is you talk about social norms, but surely, we talked about smartphones and whatever, but the society's demands, as working people, and there have been laws passed about this, the fact that I think it's in France, you are not, it may even be in Holland, you're in a better place than this one, going to advise me, but employers cannot phone their employees after certain times because you get your privacy. As a freelancer, I have had several people demanding where I am and why aren't I online. And it's my privacy to turn. I do not have to be on call 24/7. And if I turn my phone off for 2 or 3 days, as long as I'm not found upside down in a canal several days later, that is my right to privacy. Surely, and in this world where you can be in contact with the other side of the globe with a click of a like on a social media app, perhaps protecting privacy is an important thing.
I agree entirely. I mean, my own preference is for privacy, and I like to keep my own little world to myself. You're absolutely right. The smartphone is very difficult because it's there, 24/7, and people get up in the night and the first thing they do is look at it, and if you see the wrong email at the wrong time, then you're suddenly involved in some, and you can't get out of it, and it's all terrible. And that sort of sense of breaking down the barriers between what we might think of private life and public life has been continuing for some time, and the technology kind of does that for us. We saw a lot of shifts about our views of privacy during COVID, when there were all the lockdowns and lots of people started working from home. And of course, that completely changes the dynamic. We're all getting used to, who'd heard of Zoom? We're talking on Zoom. Who'd heard of Zoom before COVID? It's now a giant company. And it's a giant company because it enabled you to have workplace meetings. But that meant that, you were having a workplace meeting and, everyone could see the cat crawling across your bookshelves behind you and the child on your knee, and you'd have to go and answer the door and all the rest of it. And that suddenly kind of broke down a lot of barriers between the workplace and the home in sort of interesting and strange ways that we couldn't really have predicted.
There was a famous case in Spain, and I don't know if you came across this, about a TV presenter presenting his sports program from home, and a half-naked lady walked by wearing his shirt in the background, who was not his partner, and that was beamed across. And that was an invasion of privacy, if ever there was one, Kieran.
A very entertaining one, which is always good. But I haven't heard of that. But yes,
well, after this interview, please go forth and Google it, because I think there are bits sort of in the essence of privacy on a social stroke, cultural stroke, not in front of the children level. I think that's an important one to have.
That's right. And that actually raises another interesting point about privacy, which is it's very compartmental. There are things that you do not mind your partner knowing that you wouldn't want work colleagues to know, and vice versa.
Well, surely it's subjective. What I might think is a matter of privacy for you might not be a matter of privacy.
Well, that's exactly right. It is very subjective, and the subjective part makes it very hard to make rules about it.
Well, yeah, because that's my thought. Because again, then you're looking at social, legal, and moral, and that's a strange word for me to use on a Monday. Moral frameworks on this, and that is the very gelatinous nature of lawmaking for a start.
That's right. And that's really what I'm trying to get at in the book. Gelatinous is a good word. I didn't use it. I wish I had. But you're quite right, because what we try and do when either we make laws or someone like me designs a computer system is we're trying to make it possible for people to do what they want. But of course, everyone wants to do different things, and the same norm can be used to promote behaviour or to inhibit it. So, for example, we have a norm about wearing clothes in public. This is why when I go outside, I wear clothes, and I'm a good fellow in that respect. But then, for the same reason, that's why streakers like to streak, right? Because they're breaking a norm that everyone else keeps. Nobody streaks on a nudist beach. It's never been known. Right? So the fact that there are norms there are like an invitation both to keep them, but also to break them. And some people love to break the norms and some people love to keep them. And, who the hell knows?
I can just like to let the audience know that actually Kieran and I can see each other at this point, but I can only see Kieran from the waist up. So who knows? And he can only see me. Please don't stand up. Okay, I just want to confirm that he is, in fact, wearing a full set of garments. How far, joking aside, back do you go to start this? Because you could go back to privacy norms, I mean almost to hieroglyphics, couldn't you, if you would have run and really go down that rabbit hole. So where do we start with the modern, if you like, definition of privacy as a because you've got to start somewhere?
It's a good question. The real sort of academic legal approach really kick-started at the end of the 19th century, and that was with when you got the growth of the press and you got the invention of portable cameras. That was a real eye-opener for usually the middle class. This tends to be a middle class concern and not a working class concern. But in ye olden days in the 19th century, if you were going to be photographed, you had to cooperate. You stood still, you stood in front of the camera, you had to wait 3 seconds for the picture to emerge. But once the camera that could take a snapshot emerged, that could be published in a paper and seen by thousands of people, that's when the debate really kicks off.
And I mean, talking about snapshots, I mean, obviously working in the press as I have done, in the media, in the print media, I remember paparazzi, for goodness sake, before everybody had a phone on their thing. But there are times when privacy is breached and it is a problem and it has knock-on effects, and you have to take into account that what might seem a small violation of privacy can actually send off the ripples that actually have catastrophic effects.
That's a very good point. And it's growth of celebrity culture, public figures have fewer rights to privacy. That's always been accepted. If you're a public figure, then there's a public interest in knowing things about you, but there are clearly limits. A lot of celebrities like to juggle, being very open, having their, affairs and amours being publicised, just making good copy, but not being too intrusive. We talked earlier about data protection and social media. Often the problem there is precisely the cumulative thing that you were talking about. One little piece of data about you is utterly meaningless. Who cares? You add together millions of these things. It's quite a sketch of your life.
And here's the thing, it's not if your privacy is invaded, but it's if your rights are invaded. Because what I might think is an invasion of my privacy may be no such thing. But if somebody tramples on my human right, then that is a different matter altogether. And that is where you put a legal framework in.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But it only pushes the problem back one level, because when you look at the human rights laws that we have, they tend to say things like everyone has a right to a family life or private life or whatever. So you've then got to interpret what that means before you decide what your rights are. What's actually happened is that people have found that privacy, human rights get interpreted quite widely. So lots of things that you wouldn't think were to do with privacy tend to be looked at through a privacy lens. So one example would be abortion laws in America. That's a privacy decision, not something to do with the life of the child or the rights of the woman to make choices about her body. It's actually a privacy issue for women. It's a, the American privacy judgments, both Roe versus Wade and then its recent repeal, were all about whether women have the right to be private about that decision to have an abortion.
What do you hope that people will take from your book, The Seven Veils of Privacy?
I'd like people to be more interested in their privacy, but also more aware. I'd like them to be more aware, more awareness in the academic world that the problems we are dealing with are very specific problems to do with computers, to do with the state, and we're all about trying to empower people through their privacy. Actually, most people don't view privacy like that. Privacy for most people is just leave me alone. I want to get on with my own life. I want things to work. You know, I want my social media to work. I don't want it to be a problem for me. And so if we get so too enthusiastic providing complicated tools or difficult laws that are hard to use for ordinary people, they'll end up just being ignored.
The book is called The Seven Veils of Privacy, How Our Debates About Privacy Conceals Its Nature. It's by Kieran O'Hara, who we're speaking to today. Kieran, if people want to find you online without violating your privacy, where can they find you?
I don't have a social media presence for a lot of the reasons we've discussed today. My website is kieranohara.com, all one word, and then .com. I'm an emeritus professor at the University of Southampton in the UK. And so you can find me, you can email me at kmoh@soton.ac.uk. But if you Google me, you'll find me. I've got a large presence.
And the book is available as a virtual, as you can download it from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called The Seven Veils of Privacy. Kieran O'Hara, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles.